ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
If you're into cricket or football, I am just about to enter the equivalent of the MCG. For Catholics, it's the Vatican, the Tabernacle, the Holy Place. For naturalists, it's this, a $90 million new building at the CSIRO in Canberra. It's nerd mecca, and they've called it diversity. Hello? Oh, no, no. It's not an ode to political correctness. It's the new home of the CSIRO's wildlife collections, a record of biodiversity here in Australia as we know it.
If you think, what is the place where you're most likely to find a new species in Australia? It's here.
What the duck? The epicentre of new species discovery in Australia is a concrete vault in Canberra. On ABC Radio National, I'm Dr. Anne Jones.
The collection is a time machine, right? It holds information from 100 years ago into the future.
And I can't believe they're letting me inside.
Always be careful not to press that button.
Yeah. Alicia Greeley, CSIRO Research Projects Officer and Lab Manager, is pointing to a huge emergency shutdown button that looks like it will eject the pilots of all the nearby aircraft straight out of their cockpits. It's handy, right next to the button for the door, which, in true science lab fashion, sounds like it has a poltergeist running it.
Do you want to show me around?
Sure.
This place is like the start of an episode of Maxwell Smart. The doors, open to doors, open to doors.
So this is under positive pressure. So
whoa.
That, which you could probably feel when you walked in. It's so that it's kind of pushing everything out so that you aren't bringing a lot of dust and things in. So normally here you would gown up, so you have to put on a full bodysuit, a mask, goggles, boots, gloves to enter the
full
space.
Pandemic precautions.
Yes, and then when you put your boots on, you would step over this, which I'm not.
There's a bench seat right across the entrance. You have to step over it, sit on, and swing your legs. And the idea is there is no way that you can get into the next bit of the building without taking notice of the bench. And the bench means from here on in, look, don't touch, and definitely don't contaminate.
Can't take your laptops and phones in, or paper or anything like that.
This area is restricted, like Area 51 or something.
So everything that comes in has to be decontaminated, so either with bleach, because that's pretty much the only thing that will destroy DNA.
I'm pretty sure that this is what people imagine when they say, I want to be a scientist when I grow up.
I think this is the funnest part.
In fact, there's basically a whole floor of the building that's dedicated to labs and the technology required to do the delicate work that makes the most of the dead stuff that's kept elsewhere.
It's such an interesting environment to see because this for you is like your native habitat, right?
Yeah.
But for us, it's completely different than normal. I can see lines of stations, pipettes, there's freezers, there's safety showers, spinny machines, endless amounts of gloves. Everything is extremely clean, like you're probably not allowed to have your cup of tea in here.
Oh no, no food or drink.
Oh.
And we have these bottles of bleach and ethanol to clean the benches with.
This is like your high school biology room, but make it professional. Make it the latest stuff. Everything's clean and white. Hasn't been lived in yet.
Definitely have a lot of like new kit and new techniques that we want to apply to the collection to, I don't know, use the collection in new ways and, you know, figure out things that we couldn't have before.
Some of the machines in the labs look downright futuristic.
And then that's a lot of specimens. So we're using this robot. This is a robot room.
A
room for this particular robot, which is called an acoustic liquid handler. And it doesn't use pipette tips, so it's saving a lot on plastic. Ooh. It uses sound energy, I guess, to ping small volumes of liquids between things. And then this is a robotic arm that will move the plate to centrifuge. And these are heated and cooled. Is this thing gonna take your job? No.
Thank God. The future is here. The future is here. But let's face it, we're not here for the robots, no matter how cool. We're here because this is one of the world's biggest collections of Australian fauna. All of it dead. But not us, not yet. Because still to come in this episode of What the Duck, flies that murder birds, freezers full of stiff cockies, new organisational mapping for your sock drawer, and I go weak at the knees at the sight of specialised archival shelving.
So have you been to the vault before?
Not one like this vault. No, I haven't. They keep hitting banks of fluoro lights and it illuminates shelving into the middle distance. This particular vault is cutting edge in the storage of the National Insect Collection, which has an estimated value of $1 billion.
This was a really big deal for us because the collections were protected with naphthalene.
Olivia Evangelista de Souza is a curator of the CSIRO collections.
One thing that we don't have to do, for instance, is that we don't have volunteers having to spend a 3-year cycle placing naphthalene tablets on every single drawer. So that work is gone, which is great.
The new building design has already significantly reduced the mothball bill.
So going chemical-free required us to implement all sorts of like mechanic, physical, and behavioral measures so that we could protect the collections.
The risks to the collection include fire, insects eating things, UV, temperature, and moisture changes. And hence, they're in this cement bunker right in the middle of the building. Hence, the unfavourable temperature, the blinding artificial lights. In short, I pity any insect that likes to eat dead insects that tries to make its way in here.
So the first of all, in terms of risk mitigation strategy, is several layers that lead up to the vault. You see a layer there, what we call like the dirty zone, coming to the airlock, coming to the curation, the anteroom, all the way into the vault, and then the ultimate layer of protection are the cabinets.
Oh.
We have here...
That was me having a nerdgasm as Olivia reveals the cabinets that hold some of the million-strong insect collection.
Oh.
We have here maybe 100,000 slides.
And that's just the slides, the sort of thing that you'd put under a microscope. What sort of insects get stored on a slide?
So, this is like butterfly and moth genitalia. They can accommodate bits and bobs. You see, like wings, mouth parts, like really tiny pieces, all the way to entire insects. Midges, gnats, mites. Mm. We have one of the larger collections in Australia of mites, scale insects. So some of the collections are traditionally only slides. All right, so this is the pin collection.
The pin collection, what you probably imagine a butterfly collection would be like, but this one is supercharged.
I have a little less than 25,000 drawers.
25,000 drawers of pinned insects. So
yes.
Potential for how many specimens?
12 to 15 million specimens.
Holy uncooked ravioli. 12 to 15 million invertebrates.
It's difficult to quantify how many, especially because the collection should grow on an annual basis, at least 1%.
Oh, wow.
The new building has some room for expansion, drawers and shelves that are not yet filled, but will be over the next 20 years.
If you think, what is the place where you're most likely to find a new species in Australia? It's here. You could open any of these drawers and it could hold 20, 30, 50 new species that are just waiting to be described.
Olivia isn't actually talking about those new insects that will be making their way into the vault in the next 20 years, not necessarily. She's talking about the ones that are already there. Finding a new species is not like you might imagine, with a pith helmet and a machete. It's painstaking examination of drawers full of insects.
These are the largest predatory flies.
Predatory.
And they're only found in Australia.
What?
They can get up to palm-sized. Some will even kill small birds.
Dr. Keith Bayliss is a fly expert, and we're both standing next to a drawer full of blepharotes, robber flies, with pins stuck in them.
Before me, I have what looks like a cross between a beetle and a bumblebee, and the abdomen of them is ruggedized and scaled almost like a stepped pyramid. They are unlike anything I've ever seen.
And you can see across here the different species. Some have metallic in the abdomen, some have pattern wings, some don't, some have orange abdomen.
Those little things are fluffy on the side. See how they're like made of fluff.
Yeah, so these predatory flies, you can see on their face too, they have these very stout hairs, and I think it's when they're eating another insect, the insect will flail around, but they're protected from damage. So in here are several different species, and some of them are completely new to science, even though they can be palm-sized, really loud buzzing around and killing other insects and even small vertebrates. And even though these are among the largest predatory flies, there's still undescribed ones in Australia. So even in the macro, there's still dark taxa that we still need to work on.
Dark taxa. It sounds like a fee you might pay to buy something on the black market. But in this context, actually, I have no idea in this context.
Essentially, it's saying that there's dark matter and dark energy in the universe that we know it exists, but we don't really know what it is. So the same thing for insects, where we know that there's this huge amount of biodiversity out there, but we don't actually know anything about them other than that they probably exist. Dark taxa is a general term for biodiversity that we haven't characterized yet.
Oh, it's nowhere near as dramatic as the name suggests.
It is thousands of species in the soil, in the air, all around, but in Australia, some of those quote-unquote dark taxa are actually quite large and colourful.
And that means even these beastly-looking predatory flies, big enough to go from the knick-knack section through to homewares, remain unnamed or unclassified, unknown by Western science. In some cases, it's just through lack of study. Counting the hairs on a fly butt takes ages. In others, there are cryptic species, species which look as if they're the same on the outside, but when you do the genetics, they're completely different on the inside.
True, very true. And also, there's a lot in the collections where somebody did go ahead and sort them out into what they thought was a new species, and even might have put a name on it called a manuscript name, but they never took the subsequent steps to get that formally described. So there's a lot more species we know of than we officially have names for.
Yeah, because it's sort of the bureaucratic process of science, that part. So you're pretty sure, but you've got to gather all that data, get it peer-reviewed and published.
Exactly.
Australia, whipping out something else to be scared of, predatory flies that could potentially take a small bird.
They'll only bite you if you grab them.
Good to know.
On ABC Radio National, today's What the Duck is a little bit different. I'm Ann Jones and I'm being a dork. That's the same, but I'm visiting the National Wildlife Collections at the CSIRO in Canberra, where a new purpose-built building is currently filling up with dead stuff and the nerds who study it. We're now heading somewhere that makes a twitch's whiskers itch.
Stand very still, or the door will trigger.
Yep.
That's Andrea Wild, Communications Advisor at the CSIRO and the author of a book called Wild Collections.
Okay, so we're going into the clean zone again.
Okay.
Where we will go into our bird vault.
Mammals, bones and birds.
And we'll just wait for that door. This door.
We've walked into a huge windowless room, a tall ceiling, hard concrete floors. It could be a surgical theatre or something. It's so white and brightly lit. But instead of a BBL, it's filled with something else that turns nerds like me weak at the knees. Compactus.
I'm Anna Kearns. I'm the team leader of the Australian National Wildlife Collection, and I'm a research scientist here.
Are you a bird person?
Yes.
So what I'm seeing before me is these huge sort of steel cupboards that have got lots of metal, beautiful, brand spanking new, very clean drawers in them. And within the drawers, laid out like KonMari got into your sock drawer, are these specimens, so birds that have been preserved. Where should we start?
Yeah, I would like to show you, I think, straight to the ground parrots.
Oh, they are so beautiful.
The eastern ground parrots are green and yellow mottled birds, some striping to help them camouflage in their habitats.
Yeah, and so difficult to see.
Yes.
It's the easiest trip I've ever had to see a ground parrot, whose camouflage is so good it's practically an invisibility cloak. Anna has literally opened up a drawer full of them, laying there like they're forks in the cutlery drawer.
So we call these museum skins, and that's because they have been skinned out. They are literally just the skin, so there's no more guts. We do that so that they will last hundreds and hundreds of years in this climate-controlled vault situation. There are still some bits of skeleton because we keep the beaks, the legs, and then the wings are still in. But everything else is the skin and the plumage. And then we stuff them, yeah, like a little teddy bear.
Most of the birds in the wildlife collection here have cotton wool showing the place of eyes. This is not a museum collection.
Andrea Wild again.
The birds are not posed in naturalistic poses. They are study specimens. There's one exception, or two exceptions actually, in this drawer here. It's called the paradise parrot, which used to live in Queensland and nest in termite mounds.
To me, this is one of those waking dreams that you cannot grasp with your real hands, because the paradise parrot is extinct. Given the scientific name of Pulcheramus, which apparently translates as multicoloured and superlatively beautiful, it was found in the grasslands of what is now New South Wales and Queensland. But it was close to extinction by 1900 because it was a victim of the thirst for grassy woodland habitat. That's one of Australia's most sought-after ecosystems to farm. Because, well, it already looks like a farm, doesn't it? And on top of that, the termite mounds that the birds exclusively nested in, they were often trucked away to be used as tennis court bases or house flooring. And a lot of these birds were shot and collected. Because of their astounding beauty, some were also captured for the aviary trade.
This is a photo of the parlour display. So parlour displays were popular in Victorian times in England.
The Victorians liked taxidermy dioramas.
These birds were part of a display of taxidermied birds. Right. Here, I'll show you one of them.
Oh, wow.
Here we have.
Quite small.
They live up to their name. They look like a tiny bundle of paradise.
Typical of parrots, they have red and green colouring, but also this beautiful turquoise. They have a classic beak shape and two toes facing forward and two backwards. These birds went extinct in the late 1920s.
The only way I will ever see these birds is because they're in these drawers, because they were in a sort of macabre trend of interior decorating. But these days, we can have DNA samples in a freezer, so why is it important to have these skins? What role do they play in research?
They often play really critical roles.
Anna Kearns.
Our collection was established in the 60s, more or less, and some collections are much older. So they have specimens that go back to the 1800s. So there's a temporal perspective that you can get from these old specimens. We can use this sort of specimens that we've collected to look back in time and see what was going on in the species.
The options for questions you could ask seem endless, and not least of all because of the scale of this place and this collection.
Yeah, we have it all organised by taxonomy, from non-passerines, starting with your cassowaries and emus, all the way to little passerines.
What's the size of a drawer on an emu drawer? Yeah. Oh, look, oh my God, is that a brolga?
Yes, we do have.
Oh my God, lyrebirds.
I think the emus are up the top, but we can have a look at it.
Anna just said she's going to let me look at a cassowary.
Oh my God! They're like puppets. They look like they're about to come to life.
Yes, literally folded up so they will fit on the drawer.
The huge birds are curled up like Jack Russells in front of the fire.
I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't that.
I have to admit that it feels grotesque to see cassowaries like this on shelves in a cupboard because...
You know, I've never seen one in real life, alive.
Yes, neither have I, actually.
So to actually see their feathers. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Their feathers are more like emus than parrots, double-shafted and sparse hairy bits on the feather. They're fluffy and light and definitely not used for flying.
So am I allowed to touch? Okay.
Yes, you are.
Oh, wow. Whoa, the quill thing. What the... Oh, God, they're terrifying. Okay, that is... That's bizarre. I don't know why that's more bizarre than seeing the other birds, but that's really bizarre.
Turns out the scale of a bird can make me uneasy. And the scale of this place isn't helping.
Could be almost up to about 100,000 specimens.
Which is one hell of a zombie bird army. But given they don't actually come back to life at night, how has the collections team moved all of these feathers and skins from the old building and into the multi-million dollar new digs?
A lot of planning. Very complicated logistics. There was mapping done of how every specimen was laid out in our old vault, and then mapping onto moving them to these new cabinets and trays, which are different sizes. But we still also have to work on the egg collection, the mammal collection. We also have bones and paleo samples and nests as well.
What measures did you have to take to ensure that you didn't accidentally bring across a 1950s bug from the old building into the new one?
Yeah. We had an IPM procedure, which is insect pest management. So a bit of that is just visual inspection. But then we also froze the specimens for several weeks in off-site, like cold storage containers.
Every single thing was frozen for weeks to kill any pests that might have been lurking. And I've heard of dead bodies in freezers, but several million dead bodies that make up the National Wildlife Collection all being frozen? Jiminy crickets! Actually, he probably got frozen too.
And then they're brought up to temperature slowly, so we're not introducing humidity into the specimens that's going to damage them, and then they were brought here.
Oh, look, I don't want to be rude, but science is weird, right?
Yeah, it's very weird.
That's a weird thing to have to do. And if you thought of the life history of, say, I don't know, one of those ground parrots that got collected, I don't know, maybe 40, 50, 60 years ago, then lived in a dark cupboard and then got frozen.
Yeah. And now it's here in this beautiful new space. Yeah.
It's just bizarre.
Well, it is. We also
bizarre, when you think about it. Bodies of insects from gnat obsessives from 50 years ago and bits of mammals stored in jars.
Some of our colleagues will say, oh, it's a warehouse or it's a cemetery. Those things are true because we store insects. But I see the collection more as a playground. Because with this amount of information that we have of specimens over time, we can answer any question that we have now and those that we don't know we have. And there's new questions that we can answer as technology evolves. As problems come up, we're able to revisit the collection over and over. So it's more like a playground for those who have knowledge and imagination. That's why I think that the collections are so special. Like, we owe it to us and to nature and to the country to know what we have. This is it.
Shall we go across the way?
Yeah.
What's that one like?
Yeah.
And if I had my way, I'd still be there at the new home of the National Wildlife Collections at the CSIRO in Canberra, looking in the compactus, opening the cupboards, and seeing what Australia keeps in her secret biodiversity drawer. What the Duck is produced by me, Anne Jones, and Rebecca McLaren for ABC Radio National. We recorded this episode on Ngunnawal land, and then we worked on Wadawurrung, Gadigal and Tungurung country to bring it all together.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.